Futures trading is on the rise and continues to grow in popularity. The trouble has been, however, that for most traders getting started in futures, they find it overly complex and hard to manage. Though more capital efficient than stocks, futures contracts come with a slew of complex sizes and specifications that turn many traders away from them. Thankfully, this week's guest is on a mission to help make futures contracts more accessible with small, standard, and simple futures contracts.
You're listening to the Option Alpha podcast from OptionAlpha.com, where we show you how to make smarter trades, learn how the stock market really works, and generate consistent monthly income. Now, your host and head trader at OptionAlpha.com, Kirk Duplessis.
Hey everyone, this is Kirk here again from OptionAlpha.com, working every single week to make this the most popular investing podcast offered online because it's based on one thing and one thing only, and that's helping you consistently play smarter trades. So thank you again so much for tuning in today and welcome back to another interview. As I've done in previous interviews and you heard with the other interview in show number 201, we're going to release a couple of these interviews that I had previously recorded with some of our special guests. Today, we have Pete from the Small Exchange joining us, which is a really awesome interview that we recorded. We did record this back in August of last year. So again, I apologize for getting out late as we took that big pause during the rollout of our platform and beta for the new auto trading platform. But I did want to get this out because I think it's super relevant. And I think you guys are really going to enjoy our conversation with Pete today. So without further ado, let's get into the discussion with Pete. All right. So we got Pete on here. Pete, thank you so much for joining in the show.
Kirk, thanks so much for having me. This has been very exciting for me to be able to work with you and spend a little bit of time talking. I'm a huge fan. This really is a treat. And I was looking forward to spending a little time talking about futures. My history as a trader started, I was very fortunate. I started trading futures when I was 20 years old. And there's nothing better than, at that time I traded, I'm really dating myself. Before there was a euro currency, there were D-marks and French francs and Italian lira. I traded in the D-mark pit and there were 11 guys and we did about 2,000 contracts a day. And when we did 4,000, everybody walked out like there had been a tsunami. So by the time I left the floor, we were doing about 200,000 contracts a day and there were 200 guys in there. So it was great to learn and grow with the market as it grew, but it was institutional futures and big futures are challenging, especially when you start out. In my case, I think I started with $2,200 in my account. So you started with very modest means and there wasn't a great amount of lead time to learn. So you were able to, at that time, being on the floor where you were be able to be on the bid and offer, that's where you made your money, was that back and forth, buying on the bid, selling on the offer.
What's the draw to futures just in general from your background? Like, why'd you stay in futures? You know, because some people, they start in one place and they gravitate towards something else, right? So why for you was futures contracts and futures, why was it the thing?
Right. And you know what? I came from a futures trading family. My dad was a cattle broker. My grandfather was a pork belly trader. So,
oh my goodness.
I had been kind of, and I hope this doesn't sound terrible, but my grandfather, who was absolutely wonderful, passed away at the age of 92 and still had pork bellies on his trading account. So
how did those close in probate? What happened on that?
You know what? It's funny because pork bellies were something that were the Wild West. And what I mean by that is they would have these huge price swings. And I remember my first week of trading, I'm trading one lots and my hands are shaking so bad it's hard to write the trades down on the card. And at that time, they would take this card and the key punch ladies would type in the trade. And I remember the lady coming back and said, honey, you've got to slow down because I can't read what you're writing on these cards. But my grandfather came over and said, go sell these May bellies. And I'm like, I don't know anything about pork bellies. And little tiny guy, but very tough. And so I went and sold 5 May bellies. And the next morning I was so happy. I was up $1,100, which was the world at that time.
That's a lot, yeah.
Ran over, put the buy order in, covered them. Now, I remember I sold them at 112 and some change. In the next 3 months, they went down to 32 cents. And my grandfather comes back over and says, you know those bellies I told you to sell? You probably want to cover them now. And when I told him the amount, you know, what I had done and covered them for such a tiny little profit, thank goodness the chairs on the floor were, the trading floor were bolted down because he probably would have picked one up and hit me. But you live and learn. So I grew it up in that environment, which was great. I was very fortunate to start at a young age. It was something that, for me, always drew me into the financial markets. It was practical economics put into real use. So I think we've all probably studied our share of a little bit in high school, college of macro and micro. And I still don't quite know the value of a widget or what it does. And nor has it ever put a dollar in my pocket. But when you start to look at some of the context around the way macroeconomics and finance works and can put it into play and watch it unfold every day was really exciting. So I spent about 20 years on the trading floor, and it was a wonderful time. You were where the markets were being made, which every buy and sell was being matched there. It was a tremendous advantage. You learned, and this is what's interesting, Kirk, you learned by watching because you were surrounded by 200 guys, and some of them did it very well. Some of them, frankly, did it very poorly. So that collective community was a great to learn. I think one of the hardest things for guys from my time who moved from the pit trader world to the electronic trader world is they would, what we call bunker, they'd go down in their basement and, you know, buy 20 monitors and try to recreate that.
The feeling.
That feeling, right? Yeah. Right. I remember a guy even built software that when the market would rally, it would yell, buy, 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 and yell louder the faster it went. Everybody trying to replicate the sensory inputs they had from the floor. Well, that wasn't doable. And the worst thing is you were alone with your thoughts. You weren't seeing other people participate. You weren't learning. The way you work with traders now and bring to them guidance and awareness and this sense of not being alone. There are so many great ways through trading groups and other venues to start to get that collective back into your trading, which I think is so important.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm a fan of it for sure, because I think that, look, the origins of Option Alpha started with me just putting out, you know, blog posts on Google Blogspot because I knew I needed to write and talk and get my thoughts out. And
right.
Nobody was listening at that point, you know, and then collectively, you know, my friends and family and whoever would start to listen and share it. But the value of a community to not only just bounce ideas, and I'd say like a valuable community, not like, you know, there's a lot of like Reddits and subreddits of just like banter back and forth and, you know, nonsense, but a valuable community of people going back and forth is extremely powerful. And this is what masterminds are built off of, is, you know, like-minded individuals sharing successes and failures.
Absolutely. And that type of interaction is critically important to learn. We often use a term, product indifference, and the idea to be able to move to markets when there are opportunities. I think in the world of futures, product indifference, in other words, gold's moving today and natural gas is moving tomorrow, it's not so easy. You know, the world of options and equities, they did right, especially options in the equities world. Everything is 100 shares. Everything's quoted 2 decimal points to the right. There's an elegance to it where whatever you're trading, you know, Amazon options are going to move. Premium's going to move much faster than United Airlines at this moment. But the quoting conventions, the understanding of the price of a put or a call is uniform across the entire thousands of different underlyings you can trade. Futures are a very different animal. Natural gas is 10,000 million BTUs. And when I start to explain to someone what a BTU is, I feel I lose about half my audience.
Yeah, yeah,
and it just goes right. Yeah, and when you go down to the fact of the different tick sizes and the different expirations and the types of settlement, it's almost like a comedian trying out a bad act. You see the room slowly leave because the lift involved is really challenging.
And this is a good segue to what the small exchange does, and we can get into that for sure. But what I always think about, and when we talked before this offline 2-3 weeks ago, when we had a nice long chat about stuff, what I initially took away from that was that right now, correct me if I'm wrong, if this is a good analogy for it, love analogies. The futures market right now is almost like the old U.S. Confederate states, in the sense of, and when I say Confederate states, I mean like all the states before had their own currency. So there's a time where all of the states had their own currency.
Right.
North Carolina had their own currency. Yep. Virginia had their own currency. Pennsylvania had their own currency. So if you went across state lines, you would have to swap and exchange currencies. It wasn't until much later that they actually developed a central uniform United States currency, right? And so right now I look at the options market, the equities markets, et cetera, as having a uniform currency. The options market works just like you said, 100 shares in Apple is 100 shares in this, and it's the same option contract, you know, standardization. Whereas the futures market is like everyone's playing in their own little state, essentially.
It's a great analogy, Kirk. And it truly is. You know, you wonder, and I've been asked, you know, what is the conspiracy behind making this so difficult? And why do they do this? Well, you know, futures weren't built all at once. The grains were built in the early 1900s, and financial futures didn't actually come to fruition until the U.S. came off the gold standard in the 70s. So different times, different needs by users, different construction. I mean, it's hard to believe that in the world of treasury futures, they're still quoted as fractionalized 30 seconds of a point,
right,
which yeah. is challenging. So all these different things, I think it's a great analogy. There's a purpose behind the way there's built, but there's no uniformity. So
yeah. There's too many single states.
Right. Is what it is. Yeah. And right. And you make a great point because that analogy about currencies, the cost of a bushel of wheat, depending on what state you are and that currency that's underlying it, it's very different. And I think that really comes back nicely to different futures. Not only are their construction quoting different, but the amount they move every day is different. And trying to be product indifferent, which is, I want to go where the interest is. You know, you may be trading something with a $25,000 notional underlying, or you may be trading NASDAQ futures, which has close to a $230,000 underlying. So understanding the differences of those are usually we tend to learn those lessons
through experience,
negative experience when we're under stress and we're under loss. And I think one of the great challenges to adopt any product or any new asset class or type of product is the learning curve and your mechanics. And I think one of the things I know, Kirk, you and I agree on is how important mechanics are around strategy. We have strategy to define opportunity, the mechanics to manage that strategy. And probably the greatest single thing that breaks down mechanics is loss, and loss that we're not comfortable with. You know, you remember those golden days where you would walk through the trading floor and you'd sell 20 cattle and buy 10 yen and sell 20 Swiss francs, and they all worked well. And managing those days was pretty easy, but it was managing when your ideas and your positions were not performing the way your scenarios had laid out that becomes challenging. And when those losses are big and when you're uncomfortable with that movement, that's where all the mechanics you worked so hard to develop tend to break down. So
right. Let's actually backtrack a little bit and just talk a little bit about futures, because I know we have some people on here who might be familiar with futures. They've probably heard the name and the contracts, but maybe just give everyone just a quick summary of, you know, I guess you could call it like the futures 101 or some of the futures basics, right. And then we can go from there.
It's a great place to start. So futures, by their name, it's in futures contracts. So I will try to keep this as efficiently so I don't get down the rabbit hole.
By the way, anytime I've ever been asked this on a podcast, people are like, hey, Kirk, can you explain options just really quickly? And I'm always like, man, I could go so many, like how much time do you have? Because really quickly could be hours for me. I could talk all day about it. It's actually fun for me to do it in reverse. You get to be the guinea pig on this one. Yeah.
Fair enough. So a futures contract, the first part of future, it is a contract for delivery of a product or making or taking delivery of a product. And we'll talk about that at some date in the future. Now, the key component around that is that the contract is standardized. We're going to talk about a couple of terms. Standardized means the size and the quality. So I always know that if I'm trading a crude oil contract, it's 1,000 barrels. That never changes. It's always 1,000 barrels of crude. What changes is the price and the delivery time. Is it this month? Is it next month? Is the following month? So futures have different expirations. They move out at different points of time. When a futures contract expires, there's a couple of things that happens. There's two types of expiration: a cash settled, which means contract expires, you get a debit or credit in your account, and you kind of walk away, which is kind of an elegant, nice way to do it. Traditional futures have what they call physical delivery. Now, it doesn't mean any of us are going to end up with 1,000 barrels of oil in our backyard or 5,000 barrels of wheat in our driveway. there are many steps in the process that prevent self-directed and retail traders from making or taking delivery. But what these markets were built for, like all markets, were price discovery. A farmer wanted to know, he's put his crop of corn in the ground in March. He knows he's going to be harvesting it in October and November. He has no idea what he's going to be able to sell it for in October and November. So futures markets were created to have price discovery. So a market for futures would develop so that farmer knew what he could sell that contract for or his crop for. So that was the evolution and the need, price discovery. Now, we know there's a huge speculative aspect to these futures contracts. Now, what comes with a futures contract? So there are some great pieces to it. Now, leverage comes with a futures contract. We know that stocks are margined up to 50% Reg T margin. Now, futures leverage can be anywhere from 10% of the value of the contract down to 2. So it could be for a $50,000 contract, you're posting $1,000. Now, that's leverage.
That's the dangerous part. Yeah. No, I think it's the interesting part because that part right there, and again, correct me if I'm wrong because we were talking about this previously, but it's that like leverage that sometimes is required to get into a contract because they're so big in many cases that can be harmful if it goes the wrong direction.
You're exactly right. So why do you get leverage like that? You don't in the equities world. You don't get in a lot of asset classes. Well, the reason is you're not buying or selling an asset. You're buying or selling a contract. So that is a guarantee by you to perform at some point in the future. So because they're contracts, they're treated differently in terms of the world of margin. So you get this leverage. And you know, leverage can be looked at two ways, as you mentioned, pejoratively in the sense of this is very expensive if I'm wrong. Now, we can look at the other side of it, the capital efficiency, my return on capital. I'm controlling $50,000 of an asset, and I'm posting, let's say, $5,000 to do so. So if I was to put down the $50,000 and the market moved up by $5,000, I gain a 10% profit. If I was to use a futures contract, and you know this works both ways, as you said, but the capital efficiency of leverage lets me do much more with much less.
So, totally agree. Yeah, and I've always thought my analogy for leverage is that it's like medicine. Like a little bit can help, a lot can kill you.
That's a great point. So we've got these wonderful products that are capitally efficient. They are a neutral security, which means you can buy them as easily as sell them. It's not like selling stock where you've got to sell it on the uptick and borrowing it can be expensive. There is more effort in buying a stock than selling a stock short. Futures, you can buy or short at buy or sell equally easily. So it's a neutral security. It is centrally cleared, so it's guaranteed and it's very capitally efficient. You were spot on. The problem is the bite I'm having to take. In other words, I get to control $50,000. I don't want $50,000 worth of exposure. I know the $5,000 makes it very efficient, but I don't want to take these institutionally sized bites of product. I think you and I have probably learned through the many years is it's always far better to start smaller and then scale up in your trading as you find success with strategies, then be compelled to trade a product that is uncomfortable in terms of the amount of daily movement, irrespective of the capital efficiency. Yeah. If the movement wrapped around because you're having one e-mini contract is $220,000. Right before the broadcast, we talked about NASDAQ futures having a $4,000 daily range today. Now, that movement in proportion to a lot of what we do within our portfolio is a material disconnect. It's way too much exposure. That product, for better or worse, depending on how we're trading that day, completely is out of size and scope for what we're doing with the rest of our portfolio.
What I've told people too about futures, and since you know we really don't talk about them that much, and we talked about this prior to it, but this is why I'm having you on, because I think it's really good to educate people, and I'm obviously a fan of doing this and a fan of what you guys are doing at the Small Exchange. What I've told people about futures contracts is that in some cases, futures contracts are like the real estate market being completely full of 10 bedroom, 15 bath mansions, right? And like, although you can get a loan for it and the down payment might be small, it's forcing you into these homes. If real estate was the analogy here in futures, it's forcing you into these just ginormous things that you have to manage. And of course, they can go really well. I mean, you can buy a mansion and it can go up in value, but it's the management, like you said, of, right. of these major contracts versus having the ability to say, you know what, I don't need a 15-bedroom, 10-bath home. I need a 2-bedroom, 2-bath home to start. That's manageable.
And Kirk, I am definitely starting to steal your analogies because they're far better than mine.
You can take them.
So, yeah. You know what? You're absolutely right. One of the great things, though, another great thing about futures is pure product exposure. I want to trade gold. Sure, we're fortunate in the world of ETFs. We have GLD, but we also have miners and junior miners. Now, we know there's a gold part of that, but some days they wear different skins of gold miners ETF or
sure.
USO. Yep. Some days it acts like a metal. Other days it acts like an equity. So one of the wonderful things is I want to trade bonds. I want to trade gold. I want to trade crude. That's the exposure you're getting. There is nothing, you know, ExxonMobil is a large part of their business, crude oil. Absolutely. But we know it's also refinement and chemicals and so many other pieces. So there's not necessarily a great correlation between crude and an oil producer. So pure product exposure is great because it lets us find opportunities that are portfolio enhancements, ways we can add alpha and our direct expressions of our opinion. But we bump up against this issue of their over expressions of opinion basis, a lot of what we're doing in the current world. So great benefits to be had with futures, great, some great challenges to be had. Uniformity within this standardized contract is one of the key tenets. What that means is, if you've ever traded spot FX, it's a bilateral transaction, which means you buy it from a certain counterparty, and when you sell it back, it's to that same counterparty. What's great with futures is they're fungible, which means I can go in and buy a contract from Kirk in British pounds, and the marketplace guarantees me that I'm actually guaranteed that Kirk will perform on his contract. That's what the exchange does. And so when I want to go back and sell it, I don't have to go back to Kirk to ask him for a price on it. The marketplace is completely interchangeable. So whoever I buy from, I can sell to someone different as simply as possible. That's why these are tremendous pools of liquidity, because they are truly very efficient marketplaces. And, you know, Kirk, I was fortunate to see the change from moving from a pit environment to the true leveling of the playing field with electronic trading. And that has been truly revolutionary for all of us, because honestly, I remember fighting my way out of the euro currency pit to pick up a phone and trade crude oil in New York and waiting 3 hours for a fill and having no idea where you would actually get filled and inevitably never being happy with that price. With the glide of our mouse, we have access now to thousands of products.
Yeah, it's so fascinating.
It truly is. And it's, you know what? What's wonderful with futures is there's no primacy or unleveling of the playing field. Someone doesn't get ahead of you in line. If you are first in line on the bid, and there's Morgan Stanley's behind you but trying to buy a 1,000 lot, they're not getting their 1,000 lot done till your 1 lot is filled. So it is truly a level playing field. There is no advantage. If you're a bank, if you're a fund, or you're an individual, you're all treated in the same level playing field. So that's great. There, you know, you're getting the wholesale world and the equal price world. You're not getting marked up products like you do on a lot of, if you've traded certain things called CFDs in Europe, contracts for difference, or certain FX products. There are many levels of pricing in this. Retail traders, we tend to get the worst level of that.
Yeah. So, there's the regular window and then there's the other window.
Yes, yeah, right.
Exactly.
There's the good window for all the other guys and then my window. Absolutely right.
Right. So along those lines then, and I agree with what you're saying, I think that the shift that the industry continues to make and why I'm an advocate of it, not only for just traders in general, but for people who want to trade products like futures and options, is, you know, making things easier for the retail trader, making things more level in the playing field. So along those lines, let's talk about the small exchange. So your guys' goal is to really continue that push, not even continue the push, start a new push, I would say, towards standardizing contracts, making them smaller, making them more manageable for people, correct?
You're exactly right. So we were very fortunate. We've been working on this project for almost 3 years now, and each one of us at the exchange has had different experience within the futures industry, either running a firm, trading, running a prop group, or on the operations side. So we brought together this wonderful team. And when you are a startup and you're able to basically reset the table, so look what everyone has done, what's worked, and what is a barrier? What makes it hard to adopt? You know, the world of active futures traders is relatively small. Depending on how you define them, there's about 500,000 active futures traders in the US. That's a tiny fraction of the traders in the US that trade options, ETFs, or a true fraction of who either actively or passively trade equities. Part of the reason is the complexity. Part of the reason is the size. So we looked at each piece of this and we said, how can we do this better? How can we build the next evolution of product that incorporate some of the good pieces we talked to about of futures and start to eliminate some of the challenging aspects? So first and foremost for us, we built these products around kind of three tenets, three pillars: small, standard, and simple. And what I mean by small is that the notionals on our products, in other words, what I'm controlling if I buy a smalls precious metals, or what we call a SPREE future, or a STIX, our new smalls technology index, is about $5,000. So it's not $50,000 or $200,000 like the world of institutional futures.
Right. And that doesn't mean that that's what the contract costs to trade. That's just what it's controlling.
Right. So does it have leverage? It does. Just like the other world of futures, same margin model works. So you're controlling that contract for about $400 in capital. So I'm controlling $5,000 of an underlying for $400 in capital. So I'm seeing that same relative capital efficiency, but on a scale that fits much in a much better way into my world. And so a couple of the other points. So they're small, which is great. So we have products that on average move between $70 and about $110 a day. I refer to them as sleep at night products. And what I mean by that is, I've been asked so often, you know, what do I do? I don't feel I can go to sleep with these futures on because they move so much overnight. How do you do it, Pete? And really, I think every futures trader is, we either managed or stayed up all night. It's not a productive exercise. So
I do beside trades all night too.
Because the next day you're not in a position to make good decisions. So it's almost like paying a double tax, Kirk. So what we need to do is build products that are comfortable around the entire 24-hour cycle. So an $80 to $100 move is something I can be comfortable around. So how do we make them? We've made them small. How do we make them simple? Simple is really refers to a number of different things. We talked about the confusing tick sizes, or a tick is the minimum price movement for a futures contract. That's all it is. So for gold, it happens to be a dime is the tick, and there's 100 ounces in the contract. So that's a $10 move in the traditional gold futures. Now, silver is $25 and wheat is $12.50. So let's not go down that rabbit hole. It's confusing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the world of smalls. Every product, whether you're trading metals or energy or equities, the minimum tick is $1, and that is 0.01. So what our indexes look like are equities or ETFs. They're quoted 2 decimal points to the right. So it's a very comfortable way to look at pricing. You're not looking at things with hashes around them and confusing decimal points. As an aside, I trade a lot of yen futures. Now, yen, because of the way it's quoted, actually has 4 zeros in front of it before the price comes out. So a very confusing way to look at trading a product. So all smalls products look and quote like an equity or an ETF or an option, 2 decimal points to the right. What's wonderful is just like stocks where it's one penny. Whether you're trading Amazon or Exxon, you know that that minimum increment is 1 cent. And if you're trading 100 shares, that's a dollar. For futures, each contract, the minimum tick is that 100th of a, that 0.01 to 0.02, and that's a $1 tick. So that is very simple, very easy to adopt. There's nothing to learn. Once you know that, you're not going back into the world of futures catalogs to figure out what particular animal and how does it work within the existing world. Now, expiration. We talked about futures contracts. By definition, they all expire at some point in time. And Kirk, I'm not kidding you. If you go to a calendar, a futures calendar, and you open it up, you will find something expires every single trading day of that month.
Yep.
And it's just not because it's February. You'll find that in March, April, May, and June.
Yeah, so it's like chicken pox.
It is. Not only do you have to realize that each product has a different expiration that you need to be mindful of, but they expire in a different way. So all the smalls products expire on the third Friday of the month at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the best part is they're cash settled, which means if you do nothing with that contract, if you don't roll it or close it and just let it sit, that contract at 3 o'clock disappears and you are just debited or credited the expiration value against your long or short. Yep. You either get that. So it can be what we would refer to as maintenance free. There is nothing that you need to do with a cash settled product. So you've got equivalent ticks, a quoting convention that we've seen and are used to, expirations that are easy to understand and uniform. And really the products we built, so we believe we've addressed a lot of these issues that prevent, you know, it used to be firms that would prevent individuals from trading futures. You had to have $25,000 in your account. You had to have $50,000 in your account. Well, there's firms out there right now that will let you trade big futures for a tiny amount of money in your account. But the problem is you can go through that money in a single day in a single trade. It's not a productive way to learn. So the other way, previously it was the capital requirements that would kind of disqualify you. Now there's the other part of it is people disqualifying themselves, because every time we go out, Kirk, and you expand the products you're teaching and working with everyone on and embrace it yourself, there's a lift involved. If that lift is simple, it's well worth doing to add new product to your toolbox. If it's heavy, you weigh that and you say, yeah, it's not worth the effort. One of the things we talk about at the Small Exchange, build products that take your ideas to execution. Let's not put confusion between them. So each product we've built, our equity index product, our precious metals product, is actually a combination of gold, silver, and platinum. So if you want to trade precious metals, and you and I, again, were talking previously a little bit, the gold market, a very frenetic market today, silver also, but gold was kind of the wild card. On any given day, if you want to trade precious metals, you have lots of choices. You can trade gold, GLD or SLV or silver futures or platinum. Some days, if you've got a bullish assumption, there's a little bit of selection dilemma. Which one's going to be the right one for me, in my opinion? And sometimes you make the right decision, sometimes you make the wrong. We wanted to remove selection dilemma, so we made a simple expression of precious metals. I want to be long precious metals. So you're getting a slice of gold, silver, and platinum. Now, I want to be short, you're getting the same thing. Our dollar index is, you're not picking a currency pair. You're not having to choose, I want to trade euro or yen or peso. Our dollar index combines 7 currency pairs. So rather than trying to go into the world of what is the Eurozone going to do or the Bank of Japan going to do, you can simply trade the dollar. If I think the dollar is strengthening in value, I can buy it. If I think it's trading lower, I can sell it. So an expression of the dollar's relationship to the world in a simple transaction. And what's kind of neat is, I'm sure you've looked at UUP, which is a dollar index ETF.
The popular one, yep.
It is. It's kind of tough to trade. Doesn't move much. It is expensive in terms of capital use. And it's built out of a mechanism that was developed in the late 70s in terms of its weighting. Now, it's got 6 currency pairs, and one of them is the Swedish krona. And honestly, I have no agenda against the Swedes, but I've, as a currency trader for 30 years, I still don't quite understand why there's Swedish krona in this basket.
Right.
So our basket actually has some things like renminbi, the Chinese currency. So we believe this point in time, with China being such an important part of our economy and in the news every day, why wouldn't we build a revised basket that gives you that exposure? So we really believe that the key to successful products are these small, simple, and standard, but also products that resonate in our lives.
And yeah, they just make sense. Yeah. And I think, and what's cool about it and why I like all this stuff, even though I don't trade futures, but maybe I'll start after all doing all this stuff at some point. But no, what I think is cool about it is there's definitely a barrier, right? There's a barrier to getting started with futures. Right. And the barrier is numerous things. It's not just understanding the sizing. It's not just understanding the ticks and the note. You know, it's not, there's a lot of things wrapped up in it. And I think you said this before, it's great for people who want direct access to exactly this product, exactly this commodity at exactly this time. But I think there's a lot more people, and I would say on the retail side, there's definitely a lot more people who just want something easier to trade. Right. You know, they want something easier to trade that doesn't, I mean, look, our lives are super busy anyway. And so we don't need to also confuse it with trying to memorize all the tick sizes of, you know, 22 different futures contracts, right, that we're trying to trade. So I think there's a huge opportunity there. So if somebody wants to start trading these, where do they go? Because I know that's the next logical question that I would assume people are thinking right now as they're listening to this is, okay, that sounds cool. I want to investigate a little bit more. I want to, you know, see what they do and see how they move. Where do they go?
So it was important for us to build what we call a deep bench of FCMs and IBs, firms that interact with the exchange and let customers facilitate business. So there is a large swath of firms, Tastyworks, many IBs are supporting these, FC Stone, ABN AMRO, and all the clearing entities and firms that trade within them. Check with your broker. If your broker, and you, I think we've done a great job and we're onboarding new brokers and participants every single day. So check with your broker, let them know about your interest in smalls and have them reach out to us. It's interesting, Kirk. I always call it a push me, pull you strategy. We've gone out and we've made a great push into this world of brokers and FCMs and IBs that all offer futures products. I found the greatest success is us going out and giving them the information, empowering them with some tremendous education, and then them getting the push from their customers that they want to see these products. You mentioned this learning. Now, in terms of futures and markets, the smallexchange.com has a tremendous amount of education material. We have done great work on videos around product, around strategy, around, as you said, the futures 101. What's a futures contract? How does it work? And most importantly, does this fit for me? Is it the right additional product? So it's a great way to take a look at it. And honestly, we just launched a new technology index called the STIX, the Small Technology Index. And if you go to thesmallexchange.com and go to the STIX page, we are running a contest where guess the closing price of the STIX index tomorrow at 3:00. You can fill out a form, and if you get close, the five closest participants will win a prize comprised of some really cool stuff and some small exchange swag. So if you want to learn a little bit about the exchange and kind of participate in something fun, please go do that. But that's a great place to start to learn more about our products and reach out to your broker. It's a great way to, you may be surprised that they are offering small exchange products, and you can easily, if they're offering other futures, they're probably offering ours. And it's just a matter of asking your broker to permission or turn you on to look at them.
Yeah. So, and I think that's cool because, you know, what we're trying to do at Option Alpha too is very much the same with the auto trading platform that's coming out soon. And so we tell people all the time, they say, oh, is it going to be available for my broker? I'm like, well, I hope so, but you could go push them, you know, yeah. Like you could go push them and tell them, you know, that you want it so that they know. And it's very much a, like you said, I think you said a push-pull strategy or, you know, pull-push strategy. But I think the idea for me and why I think that this is important for people to understand is that the amount of options that we have, no pun intended, because I love options, but the amount of options that we have now is growing. And that's only better for us as traders. So whether Absolutely. You want to trade futures or not, And, you know, maybe a lot of people listening to this because they're options traders, they may not want to. But here's the thing I would say about futures contracts that have always been in the back of my mind. I'll totally be honest with this one. One of our advisors at Option Alpha, one of our company corporate advisors, is a guy who trades a lot of options contracts. Big name guy, great guy. One of his best strategies is to trade iron condors, and he hedges with E-mini futures.
Sure.
Because he trades them on SPX. And I've always thought, that's a fascinating way to do it, but I don't necessarily need to trade just SPX, or I don't like trading just SPX. I like trading other things. And it would always be interesting to me to be able to hedge overnight risk with futures contracts, but they were always too big, right? Uh-huh. So I look at this and I say, okay, if I'm an options trader, where does this fit in my portfolio? This type of stuff to me starts to fit when you can start to take, say, a relatively smaller portfolio and be able to potentially hedge positions with futures, right? As opposed to just going naked overnight or over the weekend or whatever the case is. And that is a really unique opportunity to take a contract that could be used in your toolbox. You may not use it all the time, but if you have a position that's going against you and you can hedge it with futures, it at least buys you enough time to unwind the position later, I think is what the end result is. So if you're an options trader listening to this, you're going, I don't know about futures. Where does it kind of fit? This is where I think it fits. And I know for me, this is where it will fit in the future, is being able to have it as a tool to say, okay, yeah, I need a hedge with, you know, whatever. Maybe like last month, we had a lot of exposure to gold. So it would have been cool at some point if we needed to be able to hedge with, you know, something that had exposure to precious metals and gold, right? And to be able to do it in a manageable way, I think is what it is.
Right. In an appropriately sized way. And you're spot on. And, you know, for us, it's not small futures or, it's small futures and. And I think you make a great point about that. Expanding our tools and the amount of product we can use to effectively maximize the efficiency of our strategies. And that is where these capitally efficient, appropriately sized futures really fit in to existing portfolios for traders who had previously never really considered futures a good match to other things they're doing. One of the things we also, and I want to mention is, and it's much more apparent on the future side, market data fees. As a professional.
I know. We pay, we have the market data stuff with the new platform, and it's just, it's crazy.
It is. And in the futures world, it's absolutely perverse. And I've always found the greatest paradox is the guys who are actually making those prices by facilitating those trades tend to pay the most to see them. And that really is a flaw. Small exchange has no market data fees, and we want to...
I'm with you. It's a speechless thing to me. And I've told my team this. I said, in a new life, when I come back later in the second coming of Kirk, and I have an opportunity to tackle bigger things, one of the things I want to tackle, I'd say two of the major things, is getting options trading globally access, like global access to trading options, right? Not just, I mean, most of it's in the US, but global access to trading. And then the second thing is like the data fees. I mean, like as a startup, right? Because I'm in the same boat that you guys are to a certain degree, like the market data fees, even in beta, are just outrageous. And I think it's just a highway crime, honestly. I think it could be reduced. Yeah.
And it's friction. And what I'm, you know, anything that I have to cover before I start to make a dollar is friction. It makes our job that much harder. And it should. We should be able to live in a frictionless environment where our transaction costs are as minimal as possible. We don't have to bear that data cost, and we're trading very
efficiently. Nowadays.
Yeah,
especially nowadays. I mean, like the cost of doing this is nothing. There's no cost to me. There's no cost to delivery, right? I mean, it's very easy to scale, but yeah, here we are. So another life, I'll tackle that.
Yeah, sure. I like that. Very good.
Yeah. Well, good, man. Well, hey, Pete, I appreciate you jumping on and chatting with me. I think this has been awesome. And I'm sure everyone, we'll have a link to everything in the show notes over at optionalpha.com. So people can definitely get a hold of you there, but I'm sure they might have questions and I'm sure they can reach out to you. So any closing thoughts, anything else we missed?
No, I can't thank you enough for having me on, and being part of Options Alpha is fantastic. So thank you again for this opportunity. And if you do, your listeners want to learn more, please go to thesmallexchange.com. You can reach out to any of us to get more information, and we'd be happy to share that with you. And thanks again, Kirk.
Hey, I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
And now our favorite part of the show, Trader Q&A, where we ask a question from one of our current members about options trading. Got a question you'd like to ask Kirk to answer live on the air? Just head on over to optionalpha.com/ask and hit the record button to leave a message. That's optionalpha.com/ask. And now, here's today's question.
Hey, Kirk, this is Lucky. I wanted to make some comments and ask a question. I really appreciate the training you put together. It's really been very beneficial for my progress over time in options trading. The question I have is, I'm going to go inverted on a iron butterfly that I put together. The iron butterfly is centered on the 270 for the SPY, and I have a width of 10 points on either side at a 260 and a 280 on the call side. I'm deep in the money on the call side, and I wanted to go inverted on this, and I was wondering how far you can go inverted. With my protection on the call side being at 280, I was wanting to roll up my put, 270 put, up to 280, which would effectively convert into somewhat of a vertical spread at that point in time. And I'm forcing a loss, I know that, but I'm deep in the money. Current price is riding at 283. We're just about a week out from expiration, and was wanting to see what your comments were on this particular deep inversion. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. So, Lucky, thank you so much for submitting the question and for the details around this. So, I think it's important that we just set the stage here again on the position. You've got a 10 point wide on either side iron butterfly that you're working with in SPY. The middle of the iron butterfly centered at 270, like you said, and then you have your long put at 260 and your long call at 280. And you're being challenged because the market is moving up higher towards your long call strike. Actually, it's already breached your long call strike and it's moving at 283. So really the question now becomes, how do you manage this thing? The difficulty with iron butterflies, of course, is that one side's always going to be slightly in the money, even when you near expiration. So even if the strikes are right at the same price point, which is 270 here, you're going to have one contract that's always slightly in the money unless the thing basically ends expiration right at 270, right? So now you're left with, how do you deal with these contracts? Well, you can roll the whole iron butterfly, which is always a choice too, right? You can remove the position now and close it and try to move the position out to the next expiration month. Probably a little bit more difficult in this case because the contracts or the underlying is already really challenging you on one side. So what you're left with is you're left with the option to go inverted, or at least one of the options is to go inverted on this position, which you already discussed. Going inverted means that you're going to either slide up part of or all of the put side position. In this case, you could roll up your short 270 puts like you suggested. And when you roll up those puts, now you're rolling them inverted. And this is inverted because now your 270 calls are going to be at a lower strike than any of your short put options. So for example, if you roll your 270 puts to 272, now you're inverted by $2. Your 272 puts are now at a higher strike than your 270 calls. And that forces you to have to buy back the entire position in the best case scenario for at least $2. So it's really important first that we talk about the width of the inversion that you're going for. So if you go inverted by $2, that sets essentially a floor or a foundation on the price of the iron butterfly post adjustment now to the width of the inversion. So one thing that you did mention here in your question, but I think is really important, is just to think about the credit that you received on the original position. This is why it's always so important to track those original credits when you're starting to think about going inverted on positions or adjusting positions, because it does make a difference. In this case, let's just assume, and I don't think that you said this in there, but let's assume that your credit was $5 that you collected. So the total credit of all the selling and buying of contracts when you originally entered the position was $5. Now, this essentially means that you've got $5 of wiggle room to go inverted on the position. So if you make an inversion and you take in some additional credit, and that credit helps push you above the $5 limit, you can technically go inverted by $5. But it doesn't force you to have to go inverted by $5 or something less than $5. That's just something that you know you can work with. You've got a $5 credit as a piggy bank, basically, in the original trade credit that you're willing to give up to defend the position if need be. So in this case, with your example where you said you could roll the position the short puts from 270 all the way up to 280, again, effectively creating a synthetic vertical spread, you'd be going inverted by $10. So could you do that? And could you collect some additional credit by going all the way up to the 280? I'd imagine that in this scenario, you probably could collect some additional credit by going all the way up to that level. However, when you get to that point, you now have to subtract the width of the inversion from your total credits that you've collected. So again, just to use some basic numbers, if we collected $5 on the original position and then rolling up our short puts collected an additional $2, we now have $7 of total credit that we've worked with. But because we've gone inverted by $10, that's forcing us into a $3 loss for the position overall. Now, that might be better than losing $5 on the original position had we not adjusted, but it still does force us into a loss because our inversion width is more than the width of the credit. Again, we've got some great podcasts on inversion, so take a look at those right here on the Option Alpha podcast. But again, thank you so much for submitting a question. Sorry for the detailed and longer answer, but I hope it helped out if you were listening out there. Remember, if you want to get your question answered here on the podcast, simply head on over to optionalpha.com/ask and click the big red button in the middle of the screen and leave me a private voicemail. Again, there's no software to download or install. Super, super easy to do, and we'll get it queued up for one of the upcoming shows.
Thanks for listening to the Option Alpha podcast. If you liked what you heard, please drop by iTunes and leave a rating or comment. Plus, you can get everything. Free email updates for future shows, transcripts, video tutorials, case studies, and more. Just visit our website at optionalpha.com.
All right, so that's a wrap for this week's podcast episode here at Option Alpha. But before you go, please keep the conversation going with us. Connect with me and our team on our favorite social media platforms and let us know what questions you have or thoughts came to mind after listening to today's show and interview with Pete. Also, I want to let you know that we've been doing a lot of bot workshops. So these bot workshops are for lead members right now because we're getting everyone into the bot program, getting started with trading and live trading. All of these bot workshops, however, have been recorded and are currently inside the university at Option Alpha. You can take a look at these completely for free. In each bot workshop that we go through, we build a complete bot together as a group and as a community, and then we post and share our different versions and templates with each other in the community. It's a really fun process to go through, and we've been doing these basically about every week. So we've got a lot of these already pre-recorded. But if you're an elite member, you can sign up and join any of the upcoming bot workshops. We'll start opening these up to everybody on the waitlist and everybody in the community very soon. But right now, we're just focusing on our elite members to make sure everyone gets on board with live trading. But again, if you're not an elite member right now, you can still check out the bot workshop recordings or any of the additional trainings that we've posted inside the university. As always, I hope you enjoyed today's episode and got at least one thing out of it that you can apply right now to help you consistently play smarter trades. Until next time, happy trading.